The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
Why does old Keb decide to put off dying for a while?
He puts off dying for a while because his grandson's life is turned upside down by a logging accident. And his grandson says, I might as well be dead. And the old man then finds a great deep purpose to go on and keep living to save his grandson's life and ultimately his own.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Alaska author Kim Hecox about his novel, Jimmy Bluefeather, winner of the 2015 National Outdoor Book Award for Literary Fiction. You've written how many nonfiction books? 12?
I think 10 or 12.
And now a novel. What turned you to fiction?
A friend of mine said recently, I thought it was an interesting statement. He said, I read nonfiction for facts, but I read fiction for the truth. And I think there's some wisdom in that. I think he's onto something by saying that, that you can dig deeper and really get deep into the humanity of so much through fiction. And so I can say things in fiction that I don't think are so easily said in nonfiction about compassion and love and some of our deepest, most important traits, and go places with this old man that I couldn't otherwise through his point of view. It gives me a certain authority, I think, so long as I develop the character carefully and authentically.
And it helps to have a philosopher as a main character.
It does help to have a philosopher as a main character. Think about the power of novels in our own history. Mark Twain's work, Uncle Tom's Cabin, all of Shakespeare's work is fiction, essentially, right? It's life-changing. It's history-making. It can alter the course of mankind. The right novel at the right time can change the world. Nonfiction as well, Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. That Huckleberry Finn, wow.
Yes. And so while you've been writing all this nonfiction, you've obviously been reading some fiction. What books have influenced you?
Well, the two books that influenced me the most in writing Jimmy Bluefeather were The Milagro Beanfield War by John Nichols, 1974, and Cold Mountain by Charles Frazier, 1997. Beautiful books, powerful, funny, at least The Milagro Beanfield War. That inspired me to use humor in Jimmy Bluefeather, you know, tragedy, comedy. I think they interweave beautifully together. The Greeks knew that. The Romans knew that. Shakespeare knew that. So I'm always reading a good novel. I always try to have a good novel and a good book or two of nonfiction that I'm deep into. I think it's important for every writer to be an assiduous reader.
Yes, learning by example. Mm-hmm. Well, I really liked the humor in your book. I think I posted on Facebook that was one of my favorite aspects of the book. Wonderful story, but the humor was really central, I think, to old Keb's character.
Yes.
And just the humor of the narrator. You mentioned Keb's grandson. His name is James.
Yes.
And he's a high school basketball player.
Yes.
He's injured while doing a summer logging job.
Yes.
His knee is ruined, basically,
yes.
So he can never play basketball again. And while everyone, the family and friends, are gathered in the hospital in Seattle waiting for his surgery and his recovery, a lot of his basketball teammates are there. And so old Keb talks to the boys, and I'd like you to read that passage. But first, tell us who Uncle Austin is.
Uncle Austin was Keb's uncle on his mother's side. And in the Tlingit culture, Keb is half Tlingit Indian. It's your mother's brother who shapes a lot of your values, and you spend as much time with him as you can. You go hunting and fishing and berry picking and spend a lot of time out in the wilds of Alaska with your mother's brother, your uncle. So Uncle Austin essentially instilled Keb with many of his values. So yes, they're down in the hospital in Seattle, and the boys are huddled up because their friend James, his life has been turned upside down. So this chapter begins. "Tell a story," Uncle Austin used to say. "We are a story people." Old Keb said into the huddle, "My sister Dot, she died of cancer in a hospital in Juneau. She was the youngest of us all and the happiest, and she was the first to die." The boys listened hard. Keb could feel it. They listened hard because the old man's tongue didn't work like it used to. Half his teeth were gone. He spoke in a soft and syncopated manner. Hearing him required effort, but he had wisdom, a great heart. The oldest man in Jinkat, he was a respected Tuxlanis elder, part Norwegian Viking berserker and part Tlingit raven trickster, as the raven rattle had the tale of the kingfisher. Austin Skredsvig, a clan leader, had raised him in the ways of the long-ago time. One of Austin's cousins had been the last shaman in Sitka, a great man who knew the language from 1,000 years ago. Most everybody in Jinkat knew stories of old Keb and his uncle Austin walking over mountains, how they traded blankets up north with the ice people, carved canoes down south with the Haida, and hunted seals in Crystal Bay. Gracie and Little Mac joined the circle, while Ruby stayed at the window, facing away and talking on her little phone. "She had an operation, my sister Dot," Keb said. "She liked to draw with pencil and paper. She got good at it. So one day, in the hospital, she made a picture of a black vase, and she put a crack in it. One crack, right down the middle. That was Dot. She did things that way. A woman visiting her dying daughter in the next bed asked Dot why. Dot said it was her scar, the one she got from the operation. You know what the other woman did? She took that drawing in the middle of the night and colored a yellow line over the scar, just like that. She told Dot it was the light coming in. That's what cracks do, she said. They let in the light."
So you've written a captivating story that also, in my opinion, shines light through the cracks of personal and cultural wounds. Was that your intention?
Yes. Yes, I wanted to explore these issues. I think they're extremely important. I wanted to root this story mostly in compassion and love. I mean, it's a risky thing for a white guy in his 50s and 60s to write about a 95-year-old man who's half Tlingit, Indian, and half Norwegian. I'm not 95. I'm not Tlingit, and I'm not Norwegian. So I tried to do it with the greatest sensitivity that I could and touch upon these issues with all the love and compassion that I could muster. It took me years running pieces by elders that I trusted. And I was still told by certain anthropologists and scholars and such, "You're going to take some heat for this book."
And have you?
Not yet. I suppose it's
coming. Newly out.
Right.
You've received good reviews.
I have. Yeah, that's nice. It's gratifying.
So where did your information about the Tlingit culture come from? Just being in Alaska?
Right. Living in Alaska. I first arrived in Glacier Bay as a young park ranger in 1979. When the bush pilot flew me out there and landed me on a gravel strip in May of 79, I thought, where are we? It was this little town of 80 people in the rain. And he turned over and looked over his shoulder. The pilot said, "Welcome to Gustavus. You can turn your watches back 100 years. And across Icy Strait from Gustavus is the town of Hoona, a Tlingit village. And people from Hoona used to live in Glacier Bay next to Gustavus, before the glacier marched down the bay and evicted them about 300 or 400 years ago. Then when the glacier retreated, the bay became a national monument under the jurisdiction of the National Park Service, but it remains their homeland of the Hoona Tlingit. So they would come over to Gustavus and tell stories. George and Jesse Dalton, I met these people when I was in my early 20s. It was profound. They talked about the great canoe culture and picking berries and hunting seal. It really moved me. And that was the beginning. Over the years, you know, a friend of mine in town adopted a young raven that had fallen out of a tree and raised this raven called Wilson. And he pointed out to me, "Kim, if you ever look at the plumage of a raven carefully, they're black, yes, but when the light hits their plumage just right, you can see there's a blue iridescence." So that played into Jimmy Bluefeather. That's a metaphor and symbolism throughout the whole book, seeing beyond the obvious.
What's the symbolism of the raven in the Tlingit culture?
Oh, he's very powerful. He created the world. He created this. Yes, the raven, the trickster raven, is hugely important in Tlingit mythology. And the raven has a sense of humor. He's a trickster.
Maybe a parallel to the coyote?
Yes.
In some of the other tribes?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, at one point in the story, Old Keb is teaching his grandson, James, how to carve, using hand tools to carve a canoe. And he tells him to learn the Tlingit language. And he says, "Words are tools, too. They shape everything." Can you say more about that?
Right. Languages are disappearing around the world. Basically, they're the intellectual warehouse of humanity. And I felt that part of this book could be dedicated in an oblique sort of way to helping to preserve the Tlingit language. There's fewer than 100 people alive today for whom Tlingit is their primary language. So a percentage of the royalties of this book are going to an organization to help preserve that language. And it was keenly important to me. I'm a writer. I love language. I see the English language being debased every day, and it pains me. So, yes, for James, he ruins his leg in a logging accident. He tells his grandpa, "My life might as well be over." And the old man, who thinks himself, he thinks he wants to die because he's in constant pain, it shakes him so profoundly. He digs deep and he teaches James that your hands can become your new legs. You're still an artist. You're not a gazelle on the basketball court anymore. You're going to become a carver. And it resurrects the entire canoe culture in the village.
Yeah, I don't want to give away the story, but it's very exciting when they set off in this canoe.
Right.
You included an entire glossary of Tlingit words in the back of the book. So you must have had some access to resources there.
I did. Many good resources published out of the University of Alaska and Sheldon Jackson College years ago. Yes, I use them in writing the book. I sprinkle Tlingit throughout the book, but I don't want to overdo it. I don't want to lose the reader with it and bog the story down too much. But yes, it's fun. The glossary also pertains to the storyline of the novel. Many of the words are about carpentry or carving or things like that, spirituality. It's a fanciful, wonderful, beautiful language.
Yeah, I didn't think you ever did it. I had no idea how to pronounce anything that you wrote in the Tlingit language. But
yeah, you're getting it.
Old Keb is a man who, you write, thinks too much. He thinks too much. And in a passage in which he is thinking about everything his Uncle Austin taught him about the natural world, Old Keb thinks this: "The more centered you are, the less you occupy the center. That's when the awareness begins." What does that mean?
Well, that's Buddhist, actually. And that means that really generosity, to develop a generous spirit and always be giving to others, then you'll find yourself. That's what Uncle Austin is basically telling his nephew, Old Keb, as Keb is a young man growing up, mentoring, sort of like Merlin did with the young Arthur, King
mm-hmm.
Arthur, right? Mm-hmm. Mentoring him through, very important. And he's basically saying, the more generous you are, the more you'll find yourself. You wake up one day and you have all these things you got to get done. Oh, I got to get this done and this, A, B, C, D, E, and F, and G. Walk away from it all and go help that guy over there put on his new roof. And you come back at the end of the day and you've done none of the things you were supposed to do for yourself, A through G. But yet you're more grounded. You feel better about yourself. And all those things you had to get done that day, you'll get them done the next day. But you went over and you showed that generous spirit. That's what Uncle Austin was saying. That's why all the canoes that Keb carved, he gave them away.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Kim Heacox about his novel Jimmy Blue Feather, winner of the 2015 National Outdoor Book Award for Literary Fiction. This program is available as a podcast and at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about the creation of Alaska Native corporations and hear about two sisters in the novel who represent opposite sides of the issues. Don't go away. I read somewhere, I think it was online, that you agree with the Dalai Lama that the world doesn't need more successful people.
Right.
What kind of people does the world need?
Peacekeepers, healers. I remember when I was growing up, I would listen to Crosby, Stills, and Nash and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan. And I remember Bob Dylan singing once about, gotta do this, gotta do that, that gotta be a success. I thought, what does he mean by that? I was young. I didn't know what he meant by that. And as I got older, I thought, well, Bob Dylan's a success. He doesn't want to turn away from his success. He wants to be able to walk in and make his next album without having to beg for it. So he's enjoying his success, I'm sure. But I think what the Dalai Lama means by that is that we're just 7 billion hamsters on a wheel. And we just need to maybe reevaluate what we're doing on this planet and think carefully about, like Wendell Berry said, you know, there are no sacred and unsacred places. There are only sacred and desecrated places. And I just flew into Missoula from Portland, Oregon, looking out the window the entire way. And I just saw manipulated landscapes the entire distance. And I thought, man, we can't leave anything alone.
Something I'm remembering in the book where Old Keb is thinking about, we start out with something little and then it has to get bigger and bigger.
Right.
Until we have just, as you say, manipulated everything.
And so through this story, I wanted to develop a story where, like with James, he can have a magnificent, beautiful life, a deeply fulfilling life that he couldn't have imagined just a few months earlier. These profound changes are possible if you open your heart to them, other ways of being and seeing.
And if you can give up the regret of not being able to play in the NBA.
There you go.
Yeah.
Exactly. And find your identity elsewhere.
I think part of what you're talking about, too, is the giving up striving, because it seems to me like striving causes a lot of this have right. to make it bigger and bigger. We're not happy with how something is.
Right.
So we see a bay, and the glacier is retreating, and we go, oh, there must be natural resources there.
Exactly.
And that's part of this story, too. There are two conflicting interests going on. Talk a little bit about the people who want to extract those resources in Crystal Bay.
Right. Crystal Bay is loosely based on Glacier Bay National Park, which is the homeland of the Huna-Tlingit. But I call it in my book Crystal Bay National Marine Reserve. I've created a new federal agency, the Marine Reserve Service, designed to protect the threatened oceans. And Keb has two remaining children, Ruby and Gracie. And Ruby is pro-corporation, and Gracie is anti-corporation, very suspicious of the corporate approach to the natural world. And we have in Alaska, ever since the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, 13 regional corporations and 203 village corporations created in Alaska that gave the natives of Alaska 12% of the land and $1 billion to invest in oil, coal, minerals, timber, tourism, fishing, and anything else they wanted to pursue. So the book talks about this, these two daughters that don't get along so well. They're uncomfortable with each other, and Keb just wants them to get along. So I do use that setup. I think it's a very important subject. When the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed in 1971, it was history-making. It was the first time in the history of humanity that indigenous peoples became sudden corporations. We had corporations that had become cultures, like Nike or General Motors or what have you, Toyota. But never before had an indigenous culture suddenly become a corporation. And so I explore that in this book with what has it done to Ruby and what has it done to Gracie. And at one point, one of the whale biologists is speaking to Gracie, the younger sister, about her older sister, Ruby. And Gracie laments, "Oh, my sister, she's just constantly lives in resentment. She wants this bay back. It used to belong to us before the glacier came down, and now it's a marine reserve. She just resents that. She's always living in resentment." And the whale biologist asks her, "Well, have you told her that? Have you talked to her about that?" Gracie says, "Yes, I did once." "Well, how did that go?" "Oh, she resented it." So I have a little fun with that. But I think it's a tragedy to live your life in resentment.
Well, it's got to eat you up from the inside.
It's going to eat you up from the inside. Now, I think it's important to live your life, to be aware and to take that awareness and to apply yourself to it. But don't let it eat you. But be aware and be a part of change, a positive part of change, if you can. Always be respectful of anybody that sees the world differently than you. Never raise your voice. Old Keb, I only have one moment in the book where he raises his voice, and I think it's startling. He startles himself.
I saw Ruby and Gracie as representative of the environmentalist against the corporation because they're so antagonistic. They just don't agree on how the resources should be used. So what's Ruby's idea of how to use the money?
Well, Ruby sits on the board of PAC Alaska, the regional native corporation, and she's the president of the PAC Alaska Heritage Trust. So the monies from the corporation that are applied toward all cultural programs and education programs, many of which are wonderful, to bring back music, dance, artistry, carving. So she's involved in all of that, and she probably makes, $200,000 to $250,000 a year. Gracie, on the other hand, is a teacher's aide at the local high school. She may makes $15,000 to $30,000 a year. She struggles to get by. She's been married several times. She's currently single. Ruby, on the other hand, the corporation, the older sister, she's got a solid marriage. She's got two successful kids. One works for the Coca-Cola Corporation. The other lives in Juneau. And that's just often the way I find that the world is. Gracie could really use more money. She's poor, but she would never take a job on the board of the corporation. Or if she did, she'd
cause trouble.
She'd cause trouble. She would. And at one point, I think I have Gracie say, she says to her father, old Keb, talking about Ruby, the older sister, "Do you know how much she makes? She makes like $200,000 to $250,000 a year." So I think she's jealous of her sister because her sister, in so many respects, is more successful than her. She has a PhD from Princeton.
And she has a lot more power. She has a lot more say over what's going to happen to the people and the natural resources.
Right. But in the end, I believe that it's Ruby that is more profoundly changed by all the events that occur in the book, the corporation lady.
I'd agree, yes. Yeah. You're also a photographer. Is this your image on the front of the book?
Right, it is. I took it in early May one spring in northern southeast Alaska, and the publisher liked it, and we ran with it.
Well, it's absolutely gorgeous.
Well, thank you. The wilderness, the mountains, the fjords, the whales, the tidewater glaciers of Alaska are essentially a character in this book. The tides, the currents, you know, once they're out on the ocean in the canoe. I mean, Keb is reading all these like a book.
Mm-hmm.
He reads the water like a book. I mean, he's a liquid person. He's part water himself.
Tell us a little bit about the small town where you live, Gustavus. What goes on there? I know you said there were 450 right. people.
Right. Yeah, there's a bumper sticker in Gustavus. It says, "What's your hurry? You're already here." So there's only about 30 miles of roads. A ferry runs out there, a state ferry runs out there twice a week. Three times a week in summer, maybe once every 2 weeks in winter. Small, single-engine Piper Cherokee planes fly back and forth with air taxis several times a day. So you get there from Juneau. It's a 25-minute plane ride, $100 one way, 55 air miles, 450 people, many of whom work for the National Park Service at Glacier Bay National Park, highly educated community, many people with PhDs and master's degrees who are marine biologists and ecologists and working for the National Park Service, people who run lodges, commercial fishing, sport charter fishing in the summertime, a school with about 80 students, bed and breakfast is mostly a tourist town that doubles in number of people every summer.
What are the summers like?
They're between 45 and 75 degrees. We might get 2 weeks of straight sunshine. We might get 3 weeks of straight rain. Not a huge temperature variation like you have here in Montana, where we have a temperate influence from the ocean, where it's sea level. So it moderates the temperature extremes. It's nice. It's not very hot. Hardly ever does it get above 80.
At the end of the book, there are four pages of Q&A in which the publisher is asking the questions. The final question was my favorite, and it goes like this. Of all the wisdom Keb shares, which predominant life lesson or lessons would you like readers to take away? So please read your response to that question.
Don't die before you're dead. Most of your limitations are in your head. Dig deep and live long, even when you're old. Find what you're most passionate about. In Keb's case, carving a canoe and traveling by canoe. And do it. Honor the past and where you came from without being blinded by ideology and too much money. Stay open to new ideas and other ways of seeing and being, to what's really true. Honor and caretake the elderly, but surround yourself with young people. Be thankful. Live in gratitude. It's seldom too late to be young again, to find the vibrant you that you might have stopped being long ago. Oh, yes. And don't let anybody take away your language, force you to wear tight shoes, or put too much sugar in your Nagoon berry pie.
Kim Hecox lives in Gustavus, Alaska. Look for more information about him at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our podcast and Twitter pages. Thank you for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.